Are you listening to this episode on Himalaya? If you are, congratulations, because you're already using the best new podcast app out there. If you're not, you're missing out. Not only does Himalaya have tons of cool features, like curated playlists and collections, along with personalized recommendations, but my brand new, members-only version of this show, called Morbidology Plus, is only available on the Himalaya app. When you become a member of Morbidology Plus, you'll get all ad-free, exclusive episodes where I'll be covering topics that I normally leave out on my free episodes. You'll even get these episodes a full 4 days early. And the best part is, Morbidology Plus is available for just $4.99 a month. For all those reasons, Himalaya is the only listening app I use, and I'm sure it will be the only one for you too. So download Himalaya and go join Morbidology Plus today. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. The two most common early signs of domestic violence are jealousy and controlling behaviour. It's easy for people to say, why don't they just leave? But statistics show that up to 75% of abused women who are murdered after they leave their abusive partners. Domestic violence comes on not like a tsunami, but as a steady wave, said Kit Grill, a survivor of domestic violence. Too often, many women do try to leave toxic and abusive situations, and tragically, they pay with their lives. It was around 10 p.m. on the 30th of December 2011 when 24-year-old Cassie Cotta told her husband Brent Cotta that she was heading to a party in Alma with a man named Brandon. When she left their apartment in Fort Smith, Arkansas, she was already intoxicated and opted to leave her car at home. Cassie had a shift the following day at Perry's Place in Fort Smith in Arkansas. It was scheduled to be a busy day at work since it was New Year's Eve. However, Cassie never showed up. The following day, Cassie's mother, Pearl, received a phone call from Brent.
I get a phone call about 4 o'clock, and it's Brent asking me if I have seen Cassie. And I said, well, she should be at work. And he said, no, she never showed up. I got on her Facebook. I started putting out there, has anybody seen Cassie? Has anybody heard from Cassie since last night? And then Facebook started blowing up because they started realizing she's not been on Facebook. Nobody's heard from her.
Brent told Pearl that Cassie hadn't shown up for work and was wondering if Pearl had seen her. When Pearl discovered that Cassie's car hadn't been moved from the previous night, she called Cassie's phone to see where she was and why she had bailed on work. Cassie was always on her phone. She was always on Facebook or texting away to friends. When Pearl called her phone, there was no answer. She tried to leave a voicemail, but the voicemail box was full. She and Brent called around all of Cassie's friends to see if anybody had seen her or heard from her. Dread washed over when nobody had, and at around 7:45 p.m. that evening, Pearl called the police to report her daughter missing. In a bid to bolster the search, Cassie's friends and family formed a social media campaign. One of her best friends, Mandy Fawcett, recollects the search.
We started searching the land next to the apartment. There was a whole bunch of pastures and trees and stuff. Maybe she took off walking and fell, you know, somewhere around the land.
Pearl informed police that the last person to see Cassie was Brent, and that this was at around 10 p.m. the previous night, before she headed to a house party. Friends and family members posted photographs and videos of Cassie on her Facebook, asking anybody who knew where she was to get in contact. They printed out missing person flyers which described Cassie as being 5 feet 3 inches tall with a petite build. She had stretched ear piercings, a lip piercing and numerous tattoos, including a gargoyle bat on her chest and the Nintendo logo on her forearm. Brent spoke with the Fort Smith television station, KHOG, and told them that he just wanted his wife to come home safely.
And Brent, just tell me about that. I mean, you've got a lot of work to do today. Yeah. We really want to bring her home.
Tell me we do. We just want her to come home safe, and that's what we're all focused on, and just figuring out what's going on and just seeing what we can do. Just the word's out there, but we need to look further. And the police have done really good. They've had a lot of manpower on this, and you know, everybody's been real cooperative, and we're just trying the best we can.
Okay, so what do you guys do next? I mean, after today, you pass
on? I don't know.
What's your last name?
Cotta.
Cotta.
Yeah.
Okay. How long have you guys been married?
Just since June of this year. We've been together about 2 years, but we got married June of this year.
And tell me something special about Cassie.
She's colorful, she's irritable, she's blunt, she's beautiful, she's perfect. She's everything you could want in somebody. She's got every little quality.
Hopefully we can bring her home, huh?
Yeah, safely.
Cassie and Brent had only been married since June, but had been together for around 2 years.
Brent went from house to house passing out flyers.
I was just going to hand you a flyer. My wife is missing.
It's all right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry,
Bobby. I was just handing out flyers. My wife was missing. I was wondering if I could drop this flyer off.
Cassie's friends and family said that she was kind and had a soft personality. She was outgoing and had a tact for making people feel special. If she walked into your room and didn't know a single person, it wouldn't take long for them to become the best of friends. She was free-spirited and was always up for a good time. Cassie was also known to be a hard worker. The owner of Perry's Place, Terry Lovell, said that he had hired Cassie because of her personality. She could always be seen with a smile on her face and was friendly to the customers and treated everybody the same. Mandy Fawcett was one of Cassie's best friends. The two had met during 7th grade at Coleman Junior High School in Van Buren, but they had attended different high schools. Shortly after high school, however, they reconnected when Mandy was working in a local restaurant and Cassie walked in. Quote, "She had a mohawk, she had piercings on her face, and I looked at her and I said, 'Cassie Gollinen, what are you doing?' she recollected. That night, the two went to a house party and were inseparable ever since, even making a pact to name their firstborn children after each other." Another one of Cassie's best friends was Erin Young.
Cassie was not a good cook at all. but she tried. It was fun. She is hyper and so sweet, a little bit mean too.
No, get the light out of my eyes. You don't want my help. You've already made it quite clear.
She would say whatever she wanted to say. She didn't care what anybody thought, but everybody loved her. Everybody loved that about her.
Cassie had a passion for music, and she had a penchant for cheering people up no matter what their problem was. Quote, "You don't normally get that feeling about people, where you meet somebody and you get the feeling that you've known them forever and can trust them with what you say," said Cassie's ex-boyfriend, Zane Cash. Before Brent, Cassie had been married to Rodney Hardy.
Cassie was the best cook ever. Let me tell you what, you always got a real thrill when she was cooking because the fire alarm would go off every time. We had several good microwaved meals. We really did.
Before Cassie and Rodney split up, they lived together with Erin and Erin's husband, Paul. The two couples got on like a house on fire, and it made living arrangements easy.
They were a little bit wild. Cassie worked nights, so they stayed up a little bit later.
Whoa!
Rodney's just full of surprises. and wants to make somebody laugh all the time.
Right on top of us.
Dude, that's because I stepped on your toes.
This is our ghost hunt video.
Hey, get about 10 feet away from me. No, you need to get about 30.
30? I can't get 30 feet away from me in this house.
I think this was the same night that Cassie burnt the burger, actually. It was just something we would do, you know, after a few beers or quite a few beers. Paul had this app that he had downloaded that we all got this kick out of, you know, it was a little ghost hunting app where you're walking around the house, you know, and it pings if there's a ghost in the room or whatnot.
All right, this is our second ghost hunt on the same night. I'm Rodney Hardy from the Super Smash Brothers. This is Paul Christian. This is Aaron Christian. This is Cassie. It's the three amigos.
Now that's funny. Who are you?
It's the three amigos. They're here. All right, let's find these guys. I bet they have sombreros on. Well, Steve Martin.
Cassie's mother, Pearl, always thought that Cassie and Rodney were such a well-suited couple.
Yeah. I know. They're both goofy. I think that's what she loved about him, is that he was about as goofy as she was. They were just both silly, and they just fed off each other like that. Just being goofy and off the wall and spontaneous, and that says both of them. They're just.
At the weekends, Rodney played in a band, and Cassie was always extremely supportive of his dreams and even helped him book gigs here and there.
Cassie was always very, very supportive, and she was always working on new ways to promote us. She was always working on t-shirt ideas and merchandise ideas. Cassie was the behind the scenes that was helping everything run smoothly. Otherwise, we would have tanked right off the bat.
However, with great success comes great responsibilities, and when Rodney's band finally took off, he frequently toured from city to city and state to state, often leaving Cassie at home.
When I got out on the road, you know, things were pretty crazy. I wasn't checking in on Cassie like I should have been. I wasn't, you know, basically I'd left everyone behind in Fort Smith, you know, and I was kind of doing my thing.
Cassie was a headstrong and independent woman, but she had enjoyed her life with Rodney, and she found it difficult to acclimatize to being alone, not knowing what Rodney was doing or who he was with.
She just didn't deal with it very well. I mean, she came to me and she cried. She did what she always did and just, you know, put it in a little box and just tucked it away in her heart.
One day, Cassie and Rodney decided that they would try an open relationship, wherein they dated other people. Shortly thereafter, the couple were at a house party when they both met Brent Cotta. Cassie and her friends took the recently divorced father under their wing and let him slot right into their lives.
Brent had some bad luck, some hard luck, and our friends felt sorry for him. I felt a little sorry for him. He was a nice guy. So he was welcome to hang out with us, you know.
As time progressed and Rodney spent more time away from home, Cassie and Brent became closer and closer. It was obvious to their friends that Brent had a crush on Cassie, and he was determined to win her over. And win her over, he eventually did. Cassie and Rodney split up for good, and she moved on with Brent. Cassie's friend, Mandy, recollects the early days of their relationship.
He would take her out on dates and, you know, spoil her, show her a lot of attention. She really just needed, you know, a guy that was always there for her.
Cassie had desperately wanted a family of her own ever since she was a young girl. Her main ambition in life was to one day be a mother. Brent already had 3 children from his previous marriage, and Cassie absolutely doted on them and they on her.
And she just thought that was the sweetest thing, you know. Her main priority was the children.
I guess so.
I did too. What can I do with you?
She treated us kids like they were her children. They got along great, you know.
Then on Valentine's Day, their family was complete when Brent brought Cassie a puppy. All black with white feet, they aptly named him Mr. Socks.
Looky there. What do you think?
His name is Mr. Socks. That's Cassie's Valentine's Day present. That's y'all's surprise, okay?
She had been wanting a puppy. I remember when she brought him home and she brought him over and why she called him Mr. Socks. He was pure black, but his little feet were white. So that's where the name came is, Mr. Socks.
There you go. Careful, he may pee, so...
By all public appearances, following Cassie's disappearance, Brent was a loving and caring husband. However, behind closed doors, things couldn't have been further from the truth. The couple had a very tumultuous relationship, to say the least. In a bid to make ends meet, Brent got a job out of state at an oil field while Cassie took double shifts at Perry's place. Once again, Cassie was at home alone most of the time while Brent was out at work. Despite working as many hours as they could both get, the couple still struggled financially and ended up pawning a number of their belongings.
This is only $2 a piece.
It's not bad.
How
much did you spend at Ulta?
$34. Is that
bad? Did you get your bag you wanted?
Yeah, she did tell me, you know, that they were broke, that they were struggling.
So if we're going Sunday to spend more?
They was really struggling to make ends meet.
On the 19th of September, 2010, Cassie was climbing into bed when Brent grabbed her by the hair and pulled her out of bed. Cassie attempted to fight back and Brent put his hands around her throat and began choking her. Initially, Cassie didn't want to report the incident, but then decided to when a friend advised her. However, when police tried to follow up on the report, Cassie refused to speak to them. Just the following month, a neighbor of the couple heard someone beating on her front door. When she opened the door, she found Cassie lying on the ground and Brent walking away. She immediately called police, and when they arrived, Brent attempted to flee in his car. When police ordered him to get out, Brent replied that they would have to shoot him first. However, eventually he complied and exited the vehicle. When they asked Cassie what had happened, she said that they had been downtown drinking, but Brent came home before her. She said that when she returned home, Brent was standing outside. He then kicked open the front door and got into bed. When Cassie tried to get into bed beside him, he dragged her out by her hair and pulled her around by an earring in her right ear. Brent then began to choke Cassie. He ripped off her shirt and threatened that he would kill her before he would ever allow her to leave him. Thankfully, Cassie made it outside and to her neighbor's home. Brent subsequently pleaded guilty to second-degree assault. Then on the 6th of March 2011, police were called to the couple's apartment on Johnson Street for a domestic assault complaint. Brent had pushed Cassie up a cupboard and then hit her head. When police arrived, Cassie told them that Brent had also attacked her the previous day, holding her down on the ground with his hands around her neck. She said that he had also dragged her across the floor. Brent initially said that he was so drunk that he couldn't recollect what had happened, before confessing that the fight had turned physical and conceded that he may have choked Cassie. Brent was arrested and charged with battery in the first degree. However, he pleaded guilty to a domestic battery charge and the court advised a suspended sentence over a period of 5 years, provided that Brent pay a fine and have no contact with Cassie. Later on that morning, Brent posted on Facebook, quote, "Got into some trouble, pled out this morning and moving on with my life." While Cassie posted, quote, "Brent and I are over." Nevertheless, less than 3 months later, the couple were married in a simple ceremony.
It was a really nice day, and it was all just a lighthearted thing. They were going to do it. I went with them and was the witness. And after that, we would just went and had a few drinks, and then I think we ended up going back to their apartment complex and grilling at the pool a little bit.
Shortly after the wedding, Brent was laid off from his job, meaning that Cassie was the sole breadwinner of the family. However, when it all became too much, Cassie finally found the courage to give up on the toxic marriage and kick Brent out of their apartment. She went back to her old self and spent her free time partying with her friends.
She, you know, didn't care about what everybody else thought, so she, you know, did whatever made her happy, and it was just really enjoyable to be around somebody that, you know, was stress-free. So yeah, she was a party animal too.
Hey Hey guys, as you all know, I'm always on the hunt for awesome podcasts to listen to, and I wanted to take a minute to talk about a show that I'm excited about. If you're a fan of Morbidology, then I think True Crime Historian will be right up your alley. Each Sunday, True Crime Historian remembers the famous and forgotten scandals, scoundrels, and scourges of the past, told through vintage newspaper accounts from the golden age of yellow journalism. If you like the show, make sure to check out their premium channel on Himalaya, where you can find all episodes ad-free and 24 hours early, as well as bonus content and a members-only community where you can chat with the host as well as fans of the show. Simply download the Himalaya app, search True Crime Historian, and enter promo code HISTORIAN for your first month absolutely free. So what are you waiting for? Go and check out True Crime Historian. I love the show, and I know that you will too. As mentioned earlier, Cassie was an exceptionally kind woman, and while she and Brent had split up, she still felt compassion for him. So one day, when he called her up and cried down the phone that he was cold and had nowhere to live, Cassie, of course, took pity on him.
He called and was crying to Cassie and saying that he was cold, had no place to stay. He wasn't able to see his kids because he didn't have a home. Played Cassie's soft side, and so she allowed him to come back and stay with her on the understanding that they was not together.
On the night of Cassie's disappearance at around 10:53 p.m., Cassie said to a friend on Facebook that her phone was almost dead, but asked her to call tomorrow so that they could hang out. Around 4 hours later, at 2:38 a.m., Brent posted a poem on Facebook which read, quote, "Forgive me and please stop leaving. Slow down and please believe me. I need you and you need me, always and forever, forever and always. We belong together."
By Sunday, we're now on day two of silence. No text messaging, no phone calls, no Facebooking, no Twitter, no nothing. My daughter is a social butterfly. She would not just go silent. So we knew something was wrong.
Following Cassie's disappearance, Brent immediately fell under a cloud of suspicion. Cassie's mother had informed police that Cassie had been attempting to get out of the marriage. Quote, "You can't take somebody out of something. They have to want to, but she was planning on coming home," she said. Police quickly noticed that Brent was giving inconsistent statements that they were able to disprove. Initially, Brent told police that he had went to pick Cassie up at Perry's place at around 8 p.m. on the 30th of December. He claimed that when he arrived, she had already taken a taxi back home. He said that when he returned home, he had just walked through the door when Cassie rolled up in the taxi. After a brief conversation, Brent said that he went to lie down and heard Cassie storm out of the apartment, slamming the door behind her. He claimed that when he woke up later on that night, he texted Cassie and asked where she was. Apparently, she replied to his text messages between 10:25 p.m. and 10:44 p.m. and said that she was downtown with friends.
When we were trying to figure out his whereabouts, you know, tell us your last 24 hours, he claimed to be home all night. The sense of the messages we saw from his phone was, she's on a lam running and partying. She is doing what she wants to do. She's out having a good time. She'll be home when she basically wants to be home.
In a second account, Brent said that he was asleep when Cassie came home on the 30th of December, and that he went back to sleep when she tried to initiate an argument. He said that he woke up at around 10 p.m. and placed a phone call to his ex-wife. While chatting to his ex-wife, he claimed that she told him that Cassie had called her earlier on that evening. Quote, "That's a huge line she crossed," he told police. He said that he next heard from Cassie when she sent him text messages between 10:25 p.m. and 10:44 p.m. Then, in another account, Brent said that Cassie told him she was going to a party that night and that when he woke up again at 10 p.m. she was already gone, so he had assumed that she went to the party. Brent had claimed that he hadn't left the house at all that night. With three different versions of account combined with Brent's violent history, police began to seriously look at him as a suspect in Cassie's disappearance. Soon enough, the cottage neighbour came forward to contradict Brent's claim that he had been at home all night. According to Casey Mobley, he had heard Cassie yelling at Brent that evening before things fell silent. He said that around 30 minutes later, he went downstairs and noticed Brent standing next to his white Ford pickup truck that had been backed right up to their front door.
I remember a neighbor telling us, you know, oddly, that remembered their SUV being backed up to their apartment. And, you know, the time of the day, it was late at night, which was odd. The placement was odd. And reporting to us that it left, and then at some point he came back.
Moments later, Brent went upstairs to Casey's apartment and said he was going over to his ex-wife's house to pick up some belongings. Casey looked out of the window and saw Brent load something into the pickup truck before driving off. This was at around midnight, and according to Casey, Brent returned home around an hour later. Casey's wife, Brittany Mobley, also told police about a peculiar statement Brent had made to her while in her apartment. According to Brittany, Brent had randomly said, quote, "If something was to happen to Cassie, I don't know what I would do with the body." Brittany said that she had thought nothing of the comment at the time because Brent was drunk, and typically he said strange things while under the influence of alcohol. During the investigation into Cassie's disappearance, police obtained phone records of both Cassie and Brent.
It started out seeming his story was somewhat accurate. The accuracy being the two being together on that particular night that he's saying.
GPS showed that Cassie certainly did leave the apartment like Brent had claimed.
So did he. And as you continue looking at the data, they both ended up in a rural area that was actually even in a different county from where we are. The surreal moment was that Cassie's phone stayed in this rural area. Brent caught his phone, did not. It came back home.
However, the GPS also contradicted Brent's claims that he never left the apartment after coming home. GPS placed Brent at his apartment at 10:26 p.m., but the next location pinged in the area of Hollis Lake, which was south of Van Buren. According to GPS, Brent was here at 1:25 a.m., and then the next location was back at his apartment at 2:24 a.m. According to Cassie's phone, her GPS placed her at Hollis Lake at 12:52 a.m. and her GPS remained here until 8:25 a.m., presumably when her phone battery died. So the GPS evidence placed both Brent and Cassie near Hollis Lake, but seemingly only Brent came back home.
We had clear, concrete information that he was being untruthful with us. There was no debate, there was no dispute. We need the story. We need the true story, what really happened. And we had this cell phone data. I mean, we presented him with the information that, listen, it's clear you're being untruthful.
With this new evidence, investigators headed to Hollis Lake. By this point, they had practically given up hope that Cassie would be found alive and assumed that they would be searching for her body. Unsuccessful, they confronted Brent with the inconsistencies within his statements combined with the GPS evidence. They implored him, quote, not to be a monster. Presented with the evidence, Brent shockingly confessed that he had murdered Cassie and said he would direct them to her body. They drove north on Midland Boulevard as if they were heading towards Hollis Lake. However, en route, Brent said, quote, this isn't the way to Greenwood, before joking, quote, I'm just fucking with you, you're going the right way. He also questioned if it was the phone records that got him.
He basically, once we got to the spot, he directed us exactly where we needed to go. It wasn't very far. You couldn't see it from the road, from where we stopped.
Brent directed investigators to some river bottom land just east of Van Buren and led them to Cassie's body. She was found on the edge of a wooded area on the Fort Chaff side of a levee that ran parallel to Gun Club Road, east of Van Buren. Brent was subsequently arrested and charged with Cassie's murder. Shortly after directing police to Cassie's body, Brent posted, quote, love her, on Facebook while in police custody. While being interviewed, Brent gave several versions of events which led up to him murdering Cassie. First of all, he told investigators that Cassie had, quote, set him off by bragging that she had been with another man earlier on that night. However, earlier on in the investigation, Brent had told investigators that their marriage was over and the only reason they were still living together was because he couldn't afford his own place. Next, Brent claimed that he and Cassie had been arguing when Cassie pulled out a steak knife. He claimed that when he saw the steak knife, bad memories came flooding back and he punched Cassie in the throat and she slumped to the floor. He said that Cassie lay on the floor twitching and that he had attempted to give her CPR but to no avail. According to Brent, Cassie's lips turned blue and it was evident that she was dead from the punch in the throat. Prosecutors released a statement saying that Brent had confessed to killing Cassie, but shortly thereafter he pleaded not guilty. Sebastian County Circuit Judge Michael Fitzhugh set his cash bond at $500,000. According to Sergeant Daniel Grubbs, the murder occurred at some point between 11 p.m. on the 30th of December and 1 a.m. on New Year's Eve. They believed that by the time Brent posted the poem on Facebook, he had already killed Cassie. An autopsy concluded that Cassie had been strangled to death, completely contradicting Brent's earlier claim that she had died when he punched her in the throat. Cassie hadn't been punched in the throat, she had been manually strangled. Her air supply had been cut off by somebody's hands until she slowly suffocated to death. Meanwhile, Cassie's funeral was held at Evangel Temple, following which she was buried at Mount Curry Cemetery.
At Cassie's funeral, there was so many people.
Cassie was one of a kind, a true character, a tough exterior, but a huge softie. I was so lucky to have her in my life, and it will not be the same without her. Every memory makes me smile.
Cassie definitely touched a lot of people's lives and became friends with so many in her short lifespan. She was definitely very compassionate to the ones that she loved. She loved with her whole heart.
Brent was charged with first-degree murder and ordered to stand trial for the murder of Cassie. However, before his trial went to court, he pleaded guilty to strangling Cassie to death. During the sentencing phase, Brent apologized to Cassie's mother, Pearl, and her sister, Rachel, and said that there were no words to describe the sorrow and shame that he felt. He was sentenced to 30 years in prison and was ordered to serve 21 years of that sentence before being eligible for parole. During victim impact statements, Pearl and Rachel said that they forgave Brent. Pearl said that she had one thing to tell her former son-in-law, quote, that I had forgiven him, that it was a hard decision but a necessary one. Pearl also said that it was Cassie's contagious kindness that was encouraging her to move forward with her own life. Quote, she had a heart of gold, and I know that although she doesn't like the fact where it ended up, that I know she'd also forgive him. She just had that kind of heart.
She was vibrant, outgoing, big-hearted, free-spirited, just loved life to the fullest. She had everything going for her. She was a beautiful woman that had a whole lifetime ahead of her. That was my baby.
Domestic violence is an increasing problem. Even when abusers are convicted, they very often violate restraining orders or protection orders with little or no consequences, and they routinely abandon court-ordered counseling. It's a sad and tragic fact of life that a domestic protection order is simply a piece of paper. And while Brent Cotta was ordered to stay away from Cassie Cotta, his bruised ego clearly couldn't quite handle the rejection. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'm finally back from my vacation in Florida, so I'd like to give a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Saul Vetland, Michael Turknet, and Shelby Seelock. If you're interested in supporting the show in return for exclusive episodes, ad-free episodes, early release episodes, and other goodies, then make sure you check out Morbidology on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. The links are in the description. I'd also like to thank everybody who has taken the time to leave a kind review on iTunes or wherever else you listen to your podcasts. I really do appreciate it and it truly helps me out. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And also stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing new true crime podcast, True Crime Snack Time. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Are you a true crime addict? Do you find yourself talking serial killers and missing persons at parties only to be met with uncomfortable smiles? Well, find your tribe on True Crime Snack Time, a daily podcast that gives you a little true crime snack to chew on. From January 1st to December 31st, you'll find out what happened on this day in true crime. Short, sweet, and chock full of crime, join me, Allison, on True Crime Snack Time. We're available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Follow True Crime Snack Time on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Crime Snack Pod. And remember, keep your friends close and your snacks closer.